starting all even if it's cold tomorrow. We're gonna go get extreme.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Gnarstool Podcast.
Welcome to the Gnarstool Podcast. I'm Shannon O'Grady, your science nerd and research ranger. We've got JMO, Jason Morgan here, human performance nerd, bike enthusiast, and aspiring ski bum. And today, we have Taylor Carr back on the podcast. Climber and MS squared, that's what we're calling her, meaning she's earned two masters in sports nutrition and strength and conditioning. Super stoked to have you on, Taylor.
Thanks for having me again.
Welcome back, Taylor. Nice to see you.
Before we get into our topic for today, guess what I did this weekend? Well, I didn't really do it, I guess. I was kind of on the sidelines.
Yeah, you're kind of like a sideline observer, but I really want to dive into this because...
I did buy the tickets, though.
Fair. What'd you do?
I got tickets for my husband and children to go see Metallica in Denver, which was pretty badass. Both my kids are Metallica fans. And when we found out that they were playing again and were going to be doing a show in Denver, we just couldn't say no. So we got them tickets and, I mean, they did the whole thing. It was like my daughter gave my son Liberty spikes, which was insane. She has pink hair, which she teased it out. It was definitely looking pretty metal. And my husband was looking like my husband. It was pretty funny, but they had an amazing time and it was an insane show. Broke the record for the highest attendance of any concert, 152,000 people over 2 days, which was nuts. And because we have somewhat of a history of talking about poop and shit on this podcast, I'm going to share this one thing with you that my children shared with me upon exiting the concert on the second day, like as they were in the car waiting to get into the snake line to get out of Empower Stadium. They witnessed a man get out of his car and take a shit on some toilet paper in the middle of the parking
lot. No.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. They were both like, oh, what? Couldn't believe it. You know, toilets weren't that far away. I was trying to think through. I'm like, was he just like one of those people? Did he not know the bathrooms were nearby?
Was it an emergency?
Was he the one driving?
You of all people know that when it happens, it happens.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. I mean, why do you have toilet paper though in the car?
I know that was my thing because when we were kind of discussing on our drive home from Denver yesterday, we were really like discussing why that possibly was something that happened. And I was like, I mean, he could have like at least then done it in a bag and taken it with him, found a trash or something of that nature. And my husband was like, well, he probably doesn't have like a wag bag in his car. I'm like, well, any kind of bag. He was like, well, you know, you don't have bags in your car. I'm like, well,
you
had
toilet
paper. Yeah.
I mean, I have a baby and I know Taylor has a baby, so we have all the above in our cars,
yes.
But we're also, yes. Yeah. So for context, your kids are how old?
13 and 10.
13 and 10. I'm going to put the poop story aside because I want to go back to the Metallica. Like, were their minds completely blown?
Their minds were blown. Yeah. Both of them, I think I was telling you this earlier, Jason, through a friend that plays in kind of like a, you know, what's that movie?
Oh, the School of Rock.
The School of Rock type band. We had gone to see her perform and both of them were definitely interested in, you know, picking up guitar, learning the bass, pursuing something like that. And I think this experience pretty much solidified that in their brains. The first night, a band that I didn't really know of, Ice Nine Kills, opened, and then Limp Bizkit, which
no way
we all know.
That just brought me back to middle school mode. I love Limp Bizkit.
And then, oh yeah, if I had, so I'm not a big, I love going to see music, but in smaller venues, which is why I didn't go with them. If I had to choose, I would have gone to the second night because Suicidal Tendencies, which is a favorite of mine, opened, and then Pantera.
Yeah. What a lineup.
Wow.
So, both of them were just like stoked. And the Liberty Spikes went over well with the Metallica crowd. Like, my husband said, like, the first night my son got like 60 compliments. And then the second night, like possibly more, and multiple people like asked to stop and take pictures with
him. That's amazing.
Which was rad. My daughter even put what she's dubbing guyliner on him. So she like gave him eyeliner and it was.
Yeah. He lived the rock and roll lifestyle.
Totally
I think it's time
did.
To get T-Bird his own battle vest.
Yep.
Yeah.
He earned it.
Gotta have one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
How old? Do we know how old Metallica is at this point? They're not spring chickens, but they are still rocking shit out of it.
We can look.
My favorite thing about Metallica was Lars Ulrich's cameo in the movie Get Him to the Greek when he had stolen Russell Brand's wife.
Did I never saw that movie, no.
Oh my God. It's absolutely fucking hilarious. Total sidebar there, but yeah. Here's like the most badass rock and roll drummer of our generation making fun of himself in a movie. Pretty fun.
They're in their 60s, early 60s. My husband showed me this video this morning of watching some of them get ready prior to the show, just that whole process, like where they were getting mentally, like in Power Field, the way it's set up is pretty rad. It's like the circular stage. And so I think they call it the snake pit, which surrounds the stage. And so the fans are like right there, totally interacting with the fans. James Hetfield was like getting them all psyched up but then also needed some quiet time to, I think, get in the headspace. That was pretty cool to see on our drive home yesterday. We listened to a podcast. It's a rad podcast, not as rad as this podcast, but Out of Surfer's Journal with Robert Trujillo. And that was really cool. He played in Suicidal Tendencies. He's played with Ozzy, and just kind of hearing his story was pretty rad. So yeah, I think we all had an amazing experience. Even me that didn't actually.
I mean,
attend.
I think this puts you in running for Mom of the Summer for sure. I mean, getting your young kids Metallica tickets for two nights, like that's pretty legendary.
Yeah, so, thanks.
Kudos to you.
Yeah,
that's badass.
I'm hoping they get. I'll both get stoked on music, and it would be pretty fun to see them pursue that.
I also just want to put out into the Narstool universe, if you happen to be listening to this and you are the one that shit your pants in the parking lot on night two of Metallica in Denver, get in touch. We have a shit talk t-shirt for you.
That's true. So it's true.
We want to know. And we want to know the story.
And if James Hetfield happens to be listening, come on, because you're an absolute stud of a human and I'd like to learn your secrets.
Yeah, he totally is. I mean, Robert Trujillo too, like they're all killing it. I mean, Lars Ulrich, it's impressive to see what they did. And I mean, I just watched the videos, but at 60, dude, just totally killed it.
Bringing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sick. Well, that's a nice little segue into what we're going to talk about today on the Shoot the Shit. We're going to talk all things protein. What is it? Why is it important? The different sources, how, why, and when to consume it as part of your diet for both life and athletic performance. And I'm really psyched to talk about this with you too, because it's clearly a hot button topic right now on the interwebs, and all the Instagram influencers and Instagram doctors are pushing protein, which I think is a good thing. But I'm excited to talk to both of you who have extensive scientific backgrounds, and we can actually kind of dive through the bullshit and talk about what's real and why it's important. So,
yeah, I mean, it's crazy how much people are pushing protein right now. And I'm not saying that that's completely unfounded, but it's almost, I think in some ways, the amount of protein and how much attention it's being given to some people can be off-putting. So I think this is a really relevant topic. I'm sure you've seen that too, Taylor.
Yeah. I mean, I was standing in the grocery store line just the other day, and there's a bag of popcorn right next to me that's like high protein popcorn.
Oh,
I'm like, oh my God, like, let's just keep shoving it in everything. Like, why can't we just let popcorn be popcorn?
I'm probably going to piss you both off, but I like the high protein chips. The high protein chips, hot take, are delicious. So yeah, you can make fun of popcorn, but don't make fun of my chips.
Yeah, I'm not going to make fun of your chips. I think as long as you like them, consume them, and we're going to get into the nitty gritty of protein as well. But I'm like, things that don't naturally have protein don't have to have protein, just to kind of feed into this idea that like you know, we need these obscene amounts of protein in our diet. Otherwise, we're going to wither away to nothing. But
yeah, I'm psyched to dive into this with you guys. So I think let's start at the top. What is protein? Like from a molecular level, what is it? Let's start there. We'll break it down as we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to pass the torch to Taylor in a minute, but I like to start talking about protein form when we talk about what protein is, because protein has a number of different structures that it can take, and that structure of a protein really informs on what that protein does. So that structure is determined by all of the interactions that different parts of amino acids make with one another. And it leads to these really complex foldings of proteins. And then those foldings often speak to what the protein does in our body. But if we back all of that up, the simplest form, if you unwind that complex structure, can be thought of almost as like a chain of pearls, with each one of those pearls being a different amino acid. Taylor, would you want to kind of add and bring some more background to that?
Yeah, I like your pearl analogy. I think that's great. So if we think about proteins being these organic molecules that are made up of 20 pearls, 20 different amino acids, we'll say, we've got a few of them that are essential. And so we've got our essential amino acids. You've probably heard of EAAs before. And those are what our body cannot make. And so we get those from our diet. We've got some amino acids that are conditionally essential. And so our body can't always make them. And so in times of stress, and in some cases in like pregnancy and things of that nature, our body isn't able to make certain amino acids. And then we've got non-essentials, and those are the ones that our body can produce. And so all of these 20 amino acids working together are what's helping us with our growth and repair of tissue. It's helping us replace worn cells. It, in some cases, can work as an energy source, maybe not our main energy source, but it can offer us energy. It helps with hormones, neurotransmitters, antibodies, enzymes, all sorts of things that our body protein is so important for. And so we need all 20 of these amino acids. And that's where we can get that through so many sources, like we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, I think a good way to remember the difference between essential and non-essential proteins, or proteins, excuse me, amino acids, are it's essential that we get essential amino acids from our diet because we can't synthesize them. You see that word essential being thrown in front of things like essential fatty acids, same thing. We can't synthesize them. So it's essential we get them from our food. So that's an easy way to think through what that means and how it then connects to what you're consuming and why.
So just to kind of tie it all together, amino acids in long strains compose of different proteins, correct? And then as we ingest protein, our body breaks down those proteins into the amino acids, which then have different functions in our body. Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah. Yes. Different functions in our body. You can use them to make structural proteins in your body. You can use them, as Taylor mentioned, through gluconeogenesis to create energy or create glucose, or a bunch of different uses for amino acids. Sometimes our body, you know, doesn't break down proteins into single amino acids. That's this idea of dipeptides and tripeptides, so smaller groupings of amino acids. And then we're going to get to this, but I think it's also important to know that the amino acids that are in a protein, both in terms of whether or not an amino acid is present, but then also the quantity of that amino acid in a protein varies from protein to protein. So you can have proteins that are really rich in a certain amino acid and proteins that are really low in a certain amino acid. And this is one of the ways that we assess quality among proteins is the presence or absence of certain amino acids, particularly those essential amino acids. And then not just whether or not they're there or not, but the amount of those amino acids. There's a subclass of essential amino acids I want to mention too, which is branch chain amino acids. Those are leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And the reason why they're called branched chain amino acids is amino acids have a very standard structure, but there's a side chain, and that's really that how that chemical structure and the side chain differs among amino acids is what makes them unique. And so these branched chain amino acids have kind of a branched side structure. And those are the amino acids that particularly leucine that are given a lot of credit for turning on mechanistically turning on muscle protein synthesis. So those are within the essential amino acids. And so when we look at what proteins are important for athletes to take in, we want to look at essential amino acid quantity, but we also want to look at branched chain amino acid presence or and quantity, and particularly that of leucine.
Awesome. Thanks for clarifying that. I think, yeah, a lot of people, myself included, get caught up with all the acronyms, EAAs, BCAAs. So yeah, thanks for kind of chopping that up and making sense of how everything's put together.
Yeah. Taylor, anything you want to add on kind of BCAA content or importance before we move on?
Not necessarily. I think we're going to come about to talking about complete and incomplete proteins. And so the different levels of each of those essential amino acids, and especially of those branched chain amino acids. So I think that what you said was perfect, and yeah, I'm good with moving on to complete and incomplete if that works for you.
Yeah, I think this is a place where, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation out on the internet as far as nutrition goes, but this is one where sometimes I think there's some confusion over the definition. I think there's no confusion over the definition of a complete protein, which is that the protein contains all of the essential amino acids in quantities that are needed by human beings for good nutrition. It's the definition of incomplete amino acids, I think, where people get confused. So for a long time, folks thought that incomplete proteins, excuse me, I said amino acids previously, but incomplete proteins completely lacked certain essential amino acids. But and that while that can be true, folks often get that confused with lower quantities of certain essential amino acids. An example would be rice protein, which does contain all of the essential amino acids, but is really low. I believe it's in lysine. And so people will often refer to rice protein as an incomplete protein, but it's not because it doesn't contain all of the essential amino acids. It's because it is low in lysine. And if all you ate was rice protein, you probably would not get enough of the amino acid lysine from that one protein source. And so that's why it's important to consume, particularly if you're plant-based, to consume protein from a number of different sources so that we get the balance of those amino acids that certain plant proteins might be lower in.
Makes sense. I mean, yeah, I think combining foods is something in an era of misinformation on the internet where, you know, everybody's all in on one thing all the time, going back to the principle of diversifying your food is always a good thing. The different sources of everything, whether it be protein or carbohydrates, is always in your best interest as a human being.
Yeah, and it's not that combining, often people, when they're talking about incomplete proteins relative to plant proteins, it's in the context of like a plant-based protein powder, because you are looking for a better distribution of all of the essential amino acids in quantities that are going to be beneficial for you to take in terms of adaptation to your training. And so that's where combining complementary proteins, so something like rice and protein and a protein from a legume like beans or something of that nature, can be really nice because for a rice protein that's low in lysine, when you compare it with a legume protein that's high in lysine, it creates that balance. And that can be really important for a protein powder, but over the course of any individual's diet, as you said, Jason, you're going to be consuming proteins from different sources. And so it's not that every single meal you consume has to have those combinations, because over the course of the day, you're likely just naturally getting those combinations.
I like it. So Taylor, can you kind of take us through some of the classifications of protein? So, you know, we've got animal protein, plant-based protein. I'd like to kind of follow your lead starting at the top on what, you know, the different sources of protein are and why they're important.
Yeah, I think that we can start with animal proteins. When we're thinking about our quality of getting these different protein sources, we're thinking minimally processed and lean proteins. So beef, chicken, turkey, fish. I live in Wyoming, so we eat a lot of wild game here, elk, bison. But we're also thinking about things like eggs and cottage cheese and Greek yogurt. Maybe not as much in our Western culture, but a lot of people across the world also eat insects, which I would classify as animal proteins, even though we just don't think about them too much here. But yeah, in our animal proteins, we are looking for those minimally processed and lean proteins. Now, our plant-based proteins, we're thinking, as Shannon was talking about, lentils, beans, thinking about different soy products. So we've got tempeh and tofu, we think edamame, things like that. I think that it's important to remember that they are mostly carbohydrates, but if we're eating them overall, they're still going to count highly towards our overall protein, especially in our plant-based athletes. But that's kind of what we're looking at with our animal versus plant. I think that it's been said that plant-based proteins do have a lower digestibility than animal-based proteins, something to consider if you're a plant-based eater. But I don't think that there's anything to be too concerned with when we're thinking about the digestibility of our different proteins.
Yeah, I mean, I think often that digestibility, that lower digestibility in plant-based proteins is from something else that we need in our diet, which is fiber. So it is not necessarily a negative thing, but yes, if you're just looking at and assessing a food based on how accessible the protein in that food is, then that's something 100% to consider. You know, there are a number of different ways to measure the quality of a protein in a particular food. And typically, I mean, the most common way is look at the number of essential amino acids in that protein. So whether or not they're all there or what percentage, you know, that's what we were talking about before, relative to complete and incomplete proteins. Probably the best plant-based protein that often gets a bad name, Taylor mentioned, is soy protein. It is a complete protein, meaning it has all 9 essential amino acids in quantities that the body needs. Another important thing to look at is the proportion of essential amino acids in that protein. So not just, like I was saying before, whether or not they're there, but how much of the amino acid profile those essential amino acids make up. That's another thing where if we're looking at plant-based proteins, soy protein also shines. And then kind of the other one that Taylor mentioned is how accessible that protein is. So how well we digest it and then are able to absorb those amino acids. And that's where, not if we're looking at processed plant foods, but if we're looking at whole plant foods where fiber can sometimes make it harder for individuals to access those amino acids. I think another category that athletes in particular need to pay attention to, which is what we were talking about before, is the amount of leucine in that protein, because leucine is really the amino acid that's credited for kickstarting muscle protein synthesis.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the bad press around soy and some of the misconceptions? I mean, it's been, you know, hammered on, you know, throughout, I don't know, the last, as long as I can remember, that it's an endocrine disruptor and it changes your hormonal complex. And it's pretty funny. I think I told you the story when I was in high school, I ate everything all the time. And my mom bought these bars that she didn't want me to eat. And she told me they had soy in them. And that if I ate them, I'd turn, you know, more feminine. So I never touched them because I was terrified. And literally she only told me that so I wouldn't eat her bars. But soy is kind of shrouded in this like somewhat controversial nonsense. Is there, can either of you shed some light on where that came from and why that even picked up momentum?
So I can start, and then Taylor, if you want to hop in. I mean, soy does contain phytoestrogens, which are estrogen-like substances that can mimic the effects of estrogen in the body. Another name for these are, you know, that people may have heard for other beneficial impacts as isoflavones. But like most things, and I think this is where people often get so confused, is that the dosage is critical. So to really see that have any kind of estrogen mimicking like role in the body, you would have to consume, and I don't have like a number, but all I can say is significant amounts of soy protein. I do think this is interesting, is they have actually looked at whether or not soy can help menopausal women when we see the drop off of any estrogen production in the body. And most studies show that even consuming majority of your protein from soy does not have that impact. So you would think that if soy, you know, just the general consumption of some soy protein throughout the day, if it really were to have some kind of, you know, feminizing impact on men, then you would also see in scientific studies that it would help women whose estrogen levels have dropped to zero. And that's not the case. So from my understanding, that's the majority of the concern. And when I've looked through studies looking at that impact on a chemical level, I haven't seen any substantiation.
Yeah, I don't have much background in this area, to be completely honest, but I think that the amounts that we're looking at, and we're going to talk more about our other protein substances, but I think that's just what we're going to harp on later, is how much are we taking in and how is that actually affecting our body? And I think that soy, like so many other things, is one of those. Yeah, I think if you're taking a ridiculous amount, it could, but I haven't seen any studies that are showing any evidence that it's having any negative effects in that way, or that it's, I think that I also wrote, and I don't know much about this, but like I said before, but it's also believed that it caused breast cancer in women. I don't know, Shannon, if you've read any more about that, but that is just something that I've seen floating around on the internet as well.
I don't know a ton about that beyond the, I know that certain tumors have estrogen receptors on them. And so it might be related to the idea that they are hormone responsive tumors. And so if you're consuming higher levels of something that mimics estrogen, that could potentially lead to the growth or spreading of tumors. But similarly, yeah, I don't know a ton about it, Taylor. I just know that if, you know, it's not all breast cancer, but certain breast cancers are then given specific treatment to deal with that, the tumors that express estrogen receptors. But that's, yeah, that is way above my pay grade.
Yeah. So, you know, fundamentally, for the male listeners out there who are worried, you're good to go with soy.
It's a great protein. As we were saying before, it is like the only, I mean, pea protein is a great plant protein as well, but it's pretty much the only complete soy protein or complete protein that's plant-based that I know of.
And tempeh is good. Tastes good.
I love tofu.
Tofu, tempeh, edamame beans, like let it rip.
Yeah. Those roasted edamame beans. I'm addicted.
So good.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing those in, by the way. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for answering some of the kind of the misconceptions on the soy. I know as a male that was something I've seen and heard for a long time in kind of the bro science world. So it was good to kind of put that to rest.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I definitely see people avoid it for because of that thought. So it's a good thing to talk through. Do you want to move on to protein quantity?
Yeah. Yeah, this is fun. I like this conversation because, once again, so much information is out there nowadays that people consume a lot of their, you know, information from social media that we're told we need to eat this much protein or else. And everything, you know, is all or nothing and catastrophic fallout if you don't. So once again, I'm really kind of looking forward to hearing both of you with, you know, the scientific background talk about dosage, frequency, and why. So yeah, let's start with dose.
It's huge. I mean, like, it's funny. I'm like, well, where do I begin? I think maybe it's important to say, and I think a lot of people are familiar with this, is that the RDA is still sitting at 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass. And I think most people, maybe, I don't know if I'm correct in this, but I think most people understand that that's just not what they need. Even if they're, you know, not super active, not a high level athlete, I think most people are starting to get convinced that they might need a little bit more than that. And it's important to say that that was originally done to just prevent protein deficiency in untrained adults. And so I think that even the RDA may be taking it up a notch. I was reading and changing to 1.0, I think is what I read, is that the RDA is going to change. Do you know anything, Shannon, about that?
I haven't heard the RDA changing, but yeah, I think that's, I agree that it's important to start there, Taylor, because people hear recommended daily allowance and they're like, oh, that's what I should be taking in. But they do those studies to look at the minimum amount that you would need to consume before your body starts breaking down its own protein. So the 0.8 isn't meant to like get you jacked, right? It is just almost meant as kind of like a maintenance. It should be the bottom level. And I feel like most people, just based on the standard American diet, are well over that. Maybe not from the leanest and best sources like Taylor was talking about earlier, but it's more of a misconception of how the RDA was founded or what kind of research went into it or why they set those. It's not necessarily the amount that someone that's highly active would or should.
Got it. So to clarify, the RDA recommendations are kind of the floor, the absolute minimum.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it.
And
the floor for someone, as Taylor said, that is
sedentary. Got it. And then we're going to kind of jump over to, you know, grams per pound, because we're Americans and I'm not that good at math, but grams per pound lean mass per pound of body weight. What do you typically recommend to clients as far as the total intake for equation?
Yeah, this is just me. This is so rough, you know, but I'm just going to say it. If we're talking grams per pound, 0.55 to 1 gram per pound of body weight.
What does that translate to grams per kilo? Because I think in grams per kilo.
I know we've been doing grams per kilo for so long. 1.2 to 2.2.
I know that, but the 0.5.
Oh, the 1.2.
Okay. Yeah.
Unless I did my math completely wrong.
No, that works out great. I know the conversion, but I think because most scientific studies use grams per kilo. And so I think I've gotten so used to speaking in that. Of course, the 1 gram per pound of body weight is easy because it's just 2.2. But from there on, Taylor, you'll have to be my human calculator.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
No, but I think that it's interesting. I'll speak from just my environment at my gym that I go to. I hear so many people talking about that 1 gram per pound of body weight. And everybody, because it's so easy, right? Like, I can think about 1 gram of protein per pound of my own body weight. And I think we've got so many people striving to get up there, but is that completely necessary for that individual person? I think that this range is great. We're thinking about what our goals are. We're thinking about our activity level. We're thinking about our age, our sex, you know, all of those different factors are so important to look at. But I think that across, and again, I'm speaking from my environment, my gym, I think so many people of so many ages and goals and activity levels are still aiming for that really high number. I don't know what your experience is.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've seen numbers all over the place. I'm going to speak in kilos and you guys can translate to pounds. I would agree with the 1.2 grams of protein per kilo. As for me, that would be the floor for an active individual. Not saying that you would be doing damage if you went below that. I don't think you would. But that in order to adapt to the training that you're doing, that is the minimum amount of protein you should be taking in. And then I think there's a whole lot contained in that word adapt. So like, what type of athlete are you? Are you an endurance athlete? Are you a strength athlete? What are your goals? Are you trying to put on more muscle mass? You know, I think, like I said, and like Taylor said, it's a very individual question where you fall on that range. I have seen some meta-analyses that have looked kind of cross spectrum at athletes to determine kind of, regardless of what sport you might be into, what is a good thing to aim for. And that number I've seen more on the 1.5 to 1.6 grams per kilo, which, human calculator, do you know what that would be in terms of pounds? Taylor will get back to us on that. But I've seen that as kind of a good place for people that are training a lot and looking to recover well and looking to adapt to the training that they're doing, as that being a good place to aim for.
Are you aware of any potential risks if you take it beyond that? Like, I'm not saying people who are obsessing, like saying 2 grams per kg, like taking it too far, but if you're like, if you eat too much protein or if you eat beyond those values, is there any negative effect that happens to the body that you guys are aware of?
Taylor, I'm passing that one to you.
No, I think that kind of like backing it up to the soy, I think you would have to eat just an obscene amount of protein to see any sort of difference. I found this one particular study where they had folks, it was 30 men and women who were resistance training, and they were eating 4.4 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. And so that comes out to about 2 grams of protein per pound of body weight. Oof. Which is, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine eating that. But at the end of this study, it was an 8-week study, they found that there were no effects, even for those folks eating the 4.4. You have to imagine that the amount of calories that are also coming with that, right? They were eating about 800 more calories than the other group that was just maintaining their regular diet. And there was no fat gain despite of the extra calorie intake. And there were no changes in their body weight, fat mass, lean mass in either group. And so if you're wanting to beef up and eat 2 grams per pound of body weight, you can try it, but I don't know exactly my advice for how to get there. But it doesn't appear through at least this one study that I found, which there's maybe other and maybe some room for other studies out there, but it doesn't look like there were any adverse effects from eating that sort of diet. While resistance training, I'll also say that.
I think my biggest concern with that would not necessarily be the impact of that much protein in the diet. Although, you know, I'd love to see like longer term studies. I think we have enough people that follow the carnivore diet in this world that potentially we could look at health outcomes of that diet. But it would be the absence of nutrients that you wouldn't be consuming at the expense of consuming that much proteins, right? So are you getting less fiber in your diet, which is a major concern with people that are on the carnivore diet? And what is then, okay, you might not be getting as much fiber. What is the impact on your microflora, gut microflora. We rely on them for a number of health outcomes, but one is that there are nutrients that the microbes in our gut produce as a consequence of consuming fiber that we don't get from food sources. And so that would definitely have an impact on what microflora were present, the balance of microflora, and then the nutrients that they produce as a consequence of consuming fiber. And there's all the micronutrients also that are in, you know, vegetables and fruits that probably you would see a decrease in simply because you were consuming that much of a protein. And I know that folks that are on things like the carnivore diet do stress a lot of organ meats, which are higher in certain vitamins and minerals. But I don't believe one. I know the fiber thing isn't found in organ meats, but I also don't think that we see the same distribution of phytonutrients or micronutrients in organ meats as we see in plants. So that would be my major concern, and I'd love to see kind of a longer term study to see if that had any impact on long term health.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting concept. We can kind of go circle back to the carnivore and kind of the people who take things too far later on, because I have some interesting questions I have thought about that I want to run by you guys. But so if we kind of establish the protein range for an active individual, which Taylor mentioned was 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kg. Is that what you mentioned, Taylor, as you're recommended?
I mentioned higher. But yeah. For certain athletes, very certain specific individuals, I would say.
And we have
kind of goals.
Yeah, goals. So if we kind of just like a broad spectrum recommended intake per day, I kind of want to talk about timing of protein around a day, a training day, and also then just a normal day. So if people take days off, I'd like to compare and contrast like when you would recommend consuming more protein. And then we can kind of go from there. But on a training day, so we'll talk about a strength training day or an endurance training day. So if you're a runner, we'll just talk about, you know, we'll just lump them together. How do you recommend people front load or back load their protein intake around their training?
My general recommendation is just eating it all throughout the day. I don't totally recommend just, you know, I think a lot of people are really concerned with especially the post-workout, post-training time frame, or as we might call it, the anabolic window that a lot of people are very concerned about. I think that we've more found in nutrient timing that it's more appropriate to just continuously eat protein throughout the day rather than worrying about when exactly you're getting it in. Now, of course, you know, our muscles are being broken down and we definitely need to take in that protein after training. But I think that, again, it's more how much have you had in the morning and at lunch? Have you been eating it like consistently throughout the day rather than waiting for that 30-minute window after training?
Yeah, I would agree.
That so many people are so concerned about.
It's mainly the total amount of protein that you get in over the course of a day that's important. I don't think it's detrimental to get in protein after. I think it's more important to get in carbohydrates after. But I think if you're not consuming it, I mean, different people eat different ways, but we've talked about how hard it is to sometimes get in enough protein. And so if you don't divide that protein intake throughout the day, sometimes it can, you might err on the side of not getting in enough. And so my reason for distribution is more that and less a reason related to the impact it would have on your recovery or adaptation to training.
Interesting. Yeah. So zooming out and looking at a 24-hour period versus just hyper-focusing on the directly after training.
Yeah. I mean, they have done studies and I used to cite this study all the time. You know, science evolves. And I think any scientist that tells you or that sticks to one viewpoint or tells you that it's absolutely one way without looking at where the research has gone, you should question, you know, their reasoning. But I used to quote a study where they did look at both dose and timing throughout the course of the day and then measured total muscle protein synthesis. And the three treatments that they used were kind of large doses of protein in two meals, more moderate doses of protein, I think it was around 20 to 25 grams in four meals, and then smaller doses of protein under 10 grams in something like eight meals across the course of the day. And then they measured total muscle protein synthesis, and they saw the highest total muscle protein synthesis in that moderate group across the course of the day. And that study got cited a lot and also used to recommend both kind of an even distribution of protein intake, which once again, I believe is more, should be kind of followed, but more for the reason of just trying to actually hit, you know, a total protein intake goal. And then they also use that study as kind of a recommendation for protein dose. So saying that you had to get in at least 20 to 25 grams to really see this uptick in muscle protein synthesis. And while I think there is research supporting that, it also got interpreted that more protein wouldn't necessarily lead to higher rates of muscle protein synthesis, which more recent studies have shown is not in fact true. That's also an area of big misinformation on the internet, is a lot of people think like, oh, if you take in 50 grams of protein, your body can only use 25 grams. So the rest of that protein is wasted. Mm. And research has shown, well, one, it's not that you don't absorb the protein, you 100% do. And research has shown, I think levels as high as 100 grams of protein, we still see upticks in muscle protein synthesis. They might not be as great as the upticks we see at the lower end of that range. So say from 8 grams to 25 grams, you see a huge increase. Once you get over 40 grams, those increases become incremental as opposed to large, but you do still see an increase. It doesn't necessarily mean you should eat 100 grams of protein at a meal, but you know, just to address some of the misinformation. That's kind of where I am on the current research. Taylor, have you heard anything kind of about dose or timing?
Not really, not in any current research. I know that a lot of the older research, kind of like my example earlier, is just a lot of short-term research was done. And I think that there weren't a lot of hard endpoints, as we might call them, of like what over time the lean body mass actually ended up being when you were specific on your anabolic window. But more of the current research, I haven't looked in too much, so I can't speak highly of that. But I agree again with you that more of the nutrient timing, I think that we really need to think about is just over the course of our 24-hour day.
So throughout a course of a 24-hour day, what is your opinion on the use of supplemental protein? So obviously we're a nutrition company and we sell protein products both whey and vegan. I have always subscribed to, you know, the majority of your protein intake needs to come from whole foods. So personally, I do, you know, three meals a day of normal whole foods, and then I do a supplemental protein shake midday, you know, mid-afternoon after training. That for me has kind of been what I've done for the last decade. What ratio in your world, both personally and professionally, do you feel, you know, supplemental protein versus whole food-based protein do you recommend?
I think it's very person dependent, like how much time you have to, you know, cook food, what your, where you are in terms of budget and whether or not, you know, you can buy protein powder, a convenience item, or whether it's cheaper for you to buy, you know, whole sources of protein. I think it's very, individual, and that's a hard question to ask, although I think it's an important question to ask. I ascribe to the same kind of philosophy that of whole foods first. And for me, protein powder is a convenience item. So we've said this on this podcast many times, but supplements should be supplemental, not because there's anything inherently bad with protein powder, but because when you eat whole foods, you're often getting other nutrients that would be absent potentially in a protein powder. Obviously, you can add other things to your shake. You know, you add a bunch of different stuff. You know, you can add berries, which have a lot of phytonutrients in them. You can add fiber, you could add creatine, you know, you can add a lot of things to make that protein shake more nutritious. But I think in and of itself, when you're eating whole proteins and whole foods, you're getting more bang for your buck than eating a processed form of protein, which is what I would call protein powder. But I'm busy, you know, work a full-time job. I'm a mom. I love to train. I don't always have time to sit down and prepare a meal. And so that for me is where protein powder is 100% helpful, is that it allows me to get in my hit my protein goals when time is short.
Taylor, you're also a mom and you train hard too. So yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, we're all in the same boat here. I think that if you can get your protein goals in whole foods only, you should go for it. Because like Shannon said, you're going to get all of those other great vitamins and minerals and other nutrients from whole food sources. But we do live in such a busy world. As you said, I am a mom. I work full time. I have other goals in the mountains that I'm looking to do. And life is just so busy. And so if you're able to have that convenience of a protein powder that is going to be helpful to meet your goals, you should also go for that. And so as much as you can get from whole foods, absolutely, you should definitely be doing that. But a protein powder can also be very helpful for busy folks like me. It can be helpful for older populations that may struggle to get their protein intake for whatever reason. It can help for weight class athletes. It can help for people who just don't enjoy protein-rich foods. I love meat personally, but some people just don't like meat or other protein-rich foods, and so it can be helpful in that regard. Or people who have certain health conditions that just don't absorb protein as well. And so there's a number of reasons why people may go to a powder in order to meet their numbers.
That was a great listing of all of those reasons and some that I hadn't thought of. Nicely done, Taylor.
Yeah. No, I think that it's a really interesting perspective. And I'm also curious where you two land. So as we, you know, obviously animal based proteins are complete and
not all.
Not all.
Collagen is not.
Thank you. Good catch. Over the course, and we'll kind of zoom out of a 24-hour period and look at a week just for easy math. How many times a week is appropriate for beef versus chicken versus fish versus plant-based? You know, because I think for myself, sorry, I'm just going to hypothesize here, but as we increase beef, for example, and we're increasing our saturated fat intake, I have moderately high cholesterol, so that's something I kind of have to keep an eye on. And I think that a lot of people in this country do consume a lot of beef because it's convenient. But what role, you know, do we have to think about diversifying these protein sources for overall health? And I know I just kind of put us both on the spot here, but just something to think about. And do you guys think about that as well?
I don't eat that much red meat. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I do, but it's not, I think, like you were saying before, Taylor, like lean protein is really where the emphasis should be. And I don't eat, I leave it out of my diet less because of health concerns and more because of taste. Like I definitely do consume red meat. It's just not, I mean, we eat more, I probably eat more tofu than I eat red meat, but, and then I think secondary to that would be chicken and fish, and then last would be red meat. And I do think, I mean, your cholesterol concerns are more a genetic basis, yes?
Yeah.
So I think everybody's going to have a different answer to that question. I don't think we need to demonize red meat, but I do think saturated fat intake is something we need to watch. That's also something, though, that I think the negative health consequences at some point got overinflated, but we do need to watch our consumption of it in the diet. But I wouldn't, I don't know enough about it to make recommendations. Taylor, how about you?
I wouldn't either. I think that, as you were saying, I think that our focus should be on those lean animal sources. You know, it's summer. If our main source of protein is a hot dog, then I think maybe we have an issue. But, you know, I don't think most of us are eating hot dogs every day to get our protein. I think that if we are sticking with more of those lean cuts of red meat, then I think it's okay. But yeah, I don't really have a total recommendation on this either. I think that it is important to just remember, as Shannon was kind of saying, what do you like? And is that going to be helpful in meeting those numbers? Great. I don't think that I never would recommend someone just eating something because even though they hate it, I think that food is something to be enjoyed also. And so we have to keep that in mind when we're thinking about what our sources are as well, but certainly hitting those minimally processed and lean proteins. Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. I didn't mean to derail the conversation there, but I did think, yeah, it was important to kind of drive home the minimally processed low fat sources of meat, because I think inevitably people, especially Americans, are like, I'm going to have 9 pieces of bacon and 4 eggs for breakfast in order to hit my protein goals. And you're like, that'd be ideal, bud. But, you know,
bacon is good. Every once in a while, it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree, Jason. I think, yeah, we don't want to demonize foods, but at the same time, we just want to make sure that whatever we're including consistently in our diet is nutrient dense. So meaning that it has lots of great both macro and micronutrients, and is also lean and maybe lower on the fat content. I mean, dairy is a really high source of saturated fat too. So it's not just like fatty red meats that you might need to watch out for. I know you know that.
Good point. Good call out. So we've kind of nailed the dose, kind of the frequency. We have some fun and dive into kind of some of the myths and dumb shit that people say. You guys want to have some fun?
Sure.
I love this stuff. You know, I love this stuff. It riles me up, and I know it riles you up, Shannon. Quote, too much protein will poison your kidneys. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think Taylor already covered that with the study she found that had that absurd amount of protein for 8 weeks. Did they look at kidney function after that?
This is a different study, and the study did go up to 4.4. Let's see. The study that I was looking at was folks who were overweight or obese and had type 2 diabetes. And so they split them up into groups of a high protein diet only, no resistance training, a group of higher carb and lower protein, just diet only, no resistance training. And then they had 2 separate groups where they had those diets with resistance training. And so there were folks who were obese or overweight and type 2 diabetic that were eating 33% of their calories from protein. And so that was upwards of the 4.4 grams per kilogram of body weight. As I mentioned earlier, that goes to 2 grams per pound of body weight. And so this is important when you're thinking about kidney function, because type 2 diabetes is one of the biggest causes of kidney failure. Also being obese definitely contributes to that as well. So that's kind of why this study is important for that when we're thinking about kidneys. And so the study that I found was showing that folks who had the higher protein diet plus resistance training, there was no significant changes in kidney function while eating upwards of 4.4 grams per kilogram of body weight. It didn't show that it improved at all. And these folks did not have any sort of kidney dysfunction already, but it did not show that there was any change to their kidney function.
That was a lot of protein consumed in that, the higher end of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, that's a myth. We can say with pretty high confidence that eating a lot of protein will not damage your kidneys.
Not if you don't already have any sort of kidney dysfunction. Yeah. Like I said, this study, these folks had fully functioning kidneys and no current issues. And so, yeah, if you don't have any kidney issues, sure, eat your 2 grams per pound of body weight of protein, which is a ridiculous amount. And let me know how you did it too, because that's a lot of protein.
Yeah.
I would say no.
I think the bottom line is what you just said, that impaired kidney function, then it would be a concern. But once again, as far as how much is high for somebody with impaired kidney function, or where that cutoff should be, I have no idea. Talk to your healthcare practitioner if you fall into that group.
Awesome. My other favorite topic right now is hearing people spout off that whey protein raises your insulin levels.
You have personal experience with that, huh?
I had such a great, I wouldn't even call it an argument, heated debate with this lovely lady at an event. And she definitely subscribed to the carnivore style of ethos.
I always like starting, you know, with the idea that high insulin levels aren't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, right? That it's, yeah, it insulin functions as a way for our body to then absorb and use carbohydrates. And if you are an active person, you want that process to occur quickly. And so having a body that responds well and uses insulin to then process carbs is a wonderful thing, is a good thing. There's a reason why there are insulin receptors on our muscles. So I always like starting there. But then the idea that that whey protein, and my guess is the reason why she's saying that is because whey, and it depends on whether you're looking at a protein concentrate or a protein isolate. So isolates are more highly processed and contain less of lactose, which is the naturally occurring sugar in whey. Whey protein concentrates naturally have some lactose. My guess is she was saying that because of the lactose, or possibly because of how the possibility of your body processing some amino acids, as we mentioned, via gluconeogenesis into glucose. In reality, the amount of carbohydrate present in whey protein concentrate, or the amount of glucose that might be processed via gluconeogenesis, is not at a level that would cause a huge insulin spike. And I think we have enough studies looking at the impact of protein, whey protein specifically, on blood glucose to show that.
Yeah, it's in the bodybuilding world. If you're looking at like post-training, it's very common for those athletes to purposely try to spike their insulin after workout to start the recovery process. You know, they eat something super sweet with their protein shake right after an intense workout as a bro science way to kind of get them recovering. So it's insulin is not the enemy, I think is a good takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, it's something to be concerned about if you're pre-diabetic, if you're diabetic. Whether you have type 1 or type 2, obviously those are things to pay attention to. But it's also, one of the reasons why exercise can be used therapeutically in diabetes. Not saying that you should replace any kind of treatment that you're getting for diabetes with exercise, but it can be very helpful if done correctly and under the guidance of a healthcare practitioner, with helping you control blood sugar. And that is because of the impact of exercise on the expression of insulin receptors and then the absorption of those carbohydrates. So I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, Jason, when you addressed that comment. But
I tried to be nice, but I have a leash at some point. I have to, behave myself. I get a little mouthy. Taylor, do you have any thoughts on that?
I'll be honest. Yeah, before you asked that, I have not thought too much about protein raising insulin levels, which is probably, where I'm privileged and I don't have to think about my insulin levels that often. And I'm thankful for that. But I'm thinking about the study that I was just talking about too, in the diabetic population. And what I was reading in that study also is that all groups had showed lower signs of blood sugar after this study was done. And so I think there were, and I'm showing that there was slightly more improvement in the high protein resistance training group. And so if anything, it lowers your blood sugar. No, I can't say that for a fact, but it was showing that all approaches improve blood sugar and heart risk factors in that population. And so I like Shannon said, if you're pre-diabetic, diabetic, I think that maybe you would have more of a concern in this area. But if you're an active individual who doesn't have any of those disorders, then yeah, I don't think it's something to really be too concerned about here.
Awesome. Thanks for clarifying all the, some of the misconceptions around insulin. I think another fun one, we touched on it briefly, is the carnivore crowd. Again, I think we're not taking shots at any individual populations here, but there's a lot to kind of dissect with people who are going all in on all protein all the time. And some of the things that, the some of the consequences of that diet and lifestyle that can have that are negative on the body. But obviously cholesterol levels are a big one. Lack of micronutrients are a huge one. Lack of fiber intake. Is there anything else either of you have on kind of some of the carnivore crowd out there? Some maybe words of caution?
I think that Shannon hit it earlier, and you just said it too, is just looking at those nutrient deficiencies over time that can come from being on such a diet. I think that being low in certain vitamins and minerals, and certainly fiber is a huge one as well, is over time going to be, could be very harmful for these folks. I think it makes me laugh. Like I think about, because this is coming from, you know, studies of hunter-gatherer tribes, and I think that it's funny because a lot of those folks were eating so many plants, right?
Yeah.
And so the whole diet concept is just funny that our ancestors really only ate meat and animal organs, and I think that they really were just eating what they had, and a lot of that was plants. Would you guys agree?
I mean, I think it depends on where they're living. I agree with you 100%. Like I often hear that kind of ancestral diet as being quoted as the reason why something like the carnivore diet is more of what we should follow. My degree is in nutritional physiology. I spent a lot of time looking kind of evolutionarily at like what different animals have evolved to eat and why you see certain morphologies and physiologies in humans, in animal herbivores, in animal omnivores, in animal carnivores. And there is no question that our gut is the gut of an omnivore and our dentition is the dentition of an omnivore. It's very clear in the animal kingdom, you know, what, like, if you look at horse teeth, clearly grinding, meant to grind up fibrous foods. If you look at the gut, herbivores have very complicated guts, meant to break down fiber. Animal matter is much easier to digest. Dentition looks more like tearing dentition. Guts are very simple because you don't need that fermentation chamber to break down fiber. Omnivores are somewhere in the middle. So I think, you know, if we start by looking at our physiology and morphology, that's a simple question. And then getting back to what Taylor said, like there are, it depends on what people and where they live. And that's going to really determine, like Taylor was saying, what they eat. But even some of the tribes that you often hear referenced today, like the Maasai tribe, people often reference as this like modern day hunter-gatherer population that consumes primarily meat, but they also consume a lot of milk, which is high in what? Carbohydrates. It does have protein, but it's also very high in carbohydrates. They consume a lot of honey, which is really high in carbohydrates. You know, I think this idea that any singular one population of people consumed only meat is misinformation in and of itself. And I think, what Taylor is saying in terms of what is present in front of you is largely what your diet is going to be made up of. And then if we look at our morphology and physiology, it backs that up.
I like it. Yeah, we're definitely in an era of shock factor, and people are going all in on something and demonizing other things. So I think, you know, once again, balance is a good thing.
Well, when people start drinking blood, which I'm sure there are people out there, I mean, then we'll know we're really in, I mean, not in the nut house, because I don't want to come down on the customs of certain peoples across the world, but that the Maasai tribe, that's something that they do as well.
Yeah. Right. And I know, I think it was during World War II, they did blood pudding throughout Europe just to make sure the kids got adequate iron. And there's different time, you know, different places for different things. But
I've had blood sausage in Argentina.
It's delicious.
Wasn't my cup of tea, but I did try it.
You tried it.
Yeah. I feel like traveling.
Yeah.
Part of that is trying the cuisine of different areas you're going to.
Love it. I kind of want to tie it all back into now going back to our topic, which is protein consumption and why it's important. Shannon, I know you mentioned briefly the role of protein as we age and some of the, how things change and how our needs change as we get older. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no question that I'm just going to say it takes more to kind of turn on the machinery to not just build new muscle, but maintain muscle mass. But I guess where the confusion is, and I think where sometimes people go overboard, is what that more means. I would say that the amounts of protein that we were talking about previously, for me, that 1.5, 1.6 grams per kilo, and depending on what your goals are, just like Taylor mentioned, potentially more if you're really, really looking to put on a lot of muscle or see adaptations in that space, is fine. But it's really the coupling, like consuming protein on its own is not going to get you jacked, right? It's the coupling of that protein intake consistently with strength training, which is another, I think, subcategory of the more that's required, is really going to be the two things that are going to help us keep the muscle we have and hopefully continue to build it as we age. So I would recommend find a protein intake that seems to work for you. Don't go nuts trying to get in massive amounts of protein. If you can't get in close to that 1.5 grams per kilo, I still don't know what that is in pounds, you know, consider a protein supplement that could be helpful. And then make sure that you get in that amount as consistently as you can and that you're getting in resistance training on a regular basis.
0.68 grams per pound.
Thanks, Taylor.
No, I completely agree with you also, Shannon. I think that we've really got to think about resistance training here in the older population. And I was looking for it just now and I can't find it. Maybe I'll find it and we can share it later. But I was reading a study. I was reading an article earlier that was saying about 70 to 80% of folks today are not resistance training. They are not strength training. And I think that, well, you know, this whole thing has been about protein, which we certainly need here, but we can't just build and maintain with just eating protein. We've got to let our bodies do the work as well. And so resistance training in these populations is super critical. You know, older folks generally just aren't engaged as much. They don't move as much. And yet muscle protein synthesis slows down as well. But I think that if we can have that combination of increased protein, I think the 1.5 is probably a good number to aim for. But also coupling that with resistance training is going to be super important, not just for these populations, but for all folks out there.
Yeah, I think it's undeniable the role of resistance training in maintaining muscle mass, bone density as we age is important. And I agree that you can't isolate protein intake without talking about resistance training. They work hand in hand. So yeah, I think that's it's an important note there.
Yeah, I want to also, I was just thinking about this briefly when we were talking about quantities of protein. So we did talk, you know, we started at the RDA and then we talked kind of that lower end for athletic individuals being 1.2, that there's some research suggesting that 1.5 is a good place to hit no matter what kind of athlete you are. And that higher amounts could be helpful if you're a strength athlete and really trying to put on a lot of muscle mass. There is some research also showing that if you're trying to maintain muscle mass while in a caloric deficit, that those higher levels of protein, and that's close to the 1 gram of protein per pound of body mass, can help you maintain muscle when losing weight overall. Because, right, when you're in a caloric deficit, and losing body mass, your body's not like, ooh, I'm just going to get rid of the fat and not the protein, right? It doesn't work that way. It's looking to burn tissue to try to make up for the lower level of calories you're getting in through food. And it doesn't just burn fat. You're also going to see a loss of muscle. So doing resistance training when you're in a caloric deficit, and also pairing it with protein levels closer to that 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. I can do that one because it's an easy one. That could help you maintain some of that muscle mass despite being in a caloric deficit.
That's an important note because, when you lose weight, your body doesn't delineate between tissues, and muscle mass is calorically expensive. So evolutionarily, it is advantageous to dump muscle first when you're in a caloric deficit. So by combining an increased protein intake with resistance training, you can preserve the mass that you want.
Yeah, it's a scam. I wish we could.
You can't target. No, damn it.
Anything else that we want to cover in terms of protein?
I think putting a bow on it is protein intake is a range, diversifying the sources of your sources, diversifying between plant-based, animal-based, supplemental if you need it, and keeping in mind no one thing is bad, no one thing is a demon, and no one thing is a silver bullet. So a variety of sources of protein in your diet is going to be the best thing we can do.
Yep, totally agree. And don't go nuts. Don't drive yourself insane trying to hit some of these protein goals you see on the interwebs because I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that they're just like, I don't know. Based on my weight, I should be getting in 150 grams of protein, and there's just no way. If you like protein chips, eat them, but find a protein intake that works for you in your lifestyle. As we all agreed, try to prioritize protein from whole foods, but also use a protein powder that aligns with your income, that aligns with your diet, that aligns with your taste and you find palatable. Also would highly recommend finding one that's NSF certified to make sure that it's meeting label claims and doesn't have contaminants. But something like that, like a protein powder, can really help if you're having trouble getting that protein intake through whole foods alone.
I love it. Yeah, it shouldn't be a source of anxiety.
No, food should not be a source of anxiety.
Yeah, contrary to the interwebs, protein intake should not cause massive amounts of anxiety for people.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, food is supposed to be enjoyed. And if you are stressing about, am I meeting those numbers? How am I going to meet those numbers? Just as Shannon was saying, start small, start on a smaller number, and also start meal by meal. If you're like, I don't even eat any protein at breakfast, start there. Don't even worry about the rest of the day. Start at breakfast, increase or even just add a protein at your breakfast and go easy on yourself. Once that gets easy, then you're able to do more. And then it just adds and adds and adds until you're able to naturally and easily meet those goals.
That's great advice, Taylor.
Yeah. I think a fun way we can tie this all up is like, what's your favorite way to sneak protein in throughout your day? Do you have like a little sneaky, like, I hate to admit, I fucking love sardines. And so like I'll crush sardines every once in a while because I think they're delicious and you can both make that face at me. I don't care. They're awesome. Do you have a way that you kind of sneak protein into your diet without like when you're feeling deficient?
I mean, we already talked about them. Roasted soybeans, I absolutely love. I am not plant-based, but I do just naturally eat a lot of plant-based protein in my diet. And I very much agree with what Taylor said. Like, I just try to find little ways to add it in. So could be, you know, if I'm having Greek yogurt with my granola in the morning or with my oatmeal as opposed to, you know, just adding oat milk or something like that. It could be grabbing a chomp for a snack, or like last night I had spaghetti and we added some canned mackerel to it. Like just finding small ways to make sure that whether it's a meal or a snack, it's showing up somehow. And then I think collectively, I don't macro count anymore, but I think collectively it gets me to where I need to be.
I like it.
I agree. My diet is so boring. I'll just be very honest with you. So I'm not sneaking in anything too exciting, but I'm with you, Shannon. I was thinking mostly about my yogurt. I eat a lot of yogurt, but the yogurt I eat has like 19 grams of protein, I think. And so I'm sneaking it in those little snacks throughout the day, but protein powder and so many things also that I just regularly eat. I'm a big protein pancake fanatic, so I love my protein pancakes.
Have you ever mixed, obviously gnarly whey protein is the best, but have you ever mixed it with your yogurt?
Yes. Oh yeah, definitely mix the, well, not the whey, I've done golden milk in my plain yogurt.
I feel like it's almost like a pudding. It's like a dessert.
Damn.
So oh good. Yeah.
That's, I like that.
It's really good. The vegan mix is great in yogurt. The whey mix is great in yogurt. And the protein content skyrockets. It's insane. You take Taylor's 19 grams of protein in her serving of yogurt and then add like another 20 from either plant-based or our whey protein, and you're looking at like close to 40 grams.
Puts a nice dent in the day.
It's right insane. There.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
Hell yeah. That's good. That's a good little, I never would have thought about mixing those two. So awesome.
Well, you hate yogurt, huh?
I hate yogurt, but my wife and my young son both love yogurt. So I'm trying to be supportive.
Yeah.
I hate yogurt because I'm lactose intolerant. Let's just clear the air there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sad for you.
I know. My problem.
All right. Well, hopefully we answered a lot of questions folks have out there on protein. Also, maybe you picked up some tidbits or maybe dispelled some myths that you were curious about. But yeah, we're going to continue doing these podcasts, having Taylor on. So we have another nutrition nerd at the table, and hopefully give you guys some insight into a lot of what you're hearing as far as food and nutrition and diet, answer questions, and also cut through the BS.
Yeah, we'll keep these coming out. So if you have anything you want us to chime in on, let us know.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Non-Stool Podcast.
Something in science.